What we're talking about when we say manifestation is the true creative process wherein authentic desires become reality. Once you understand the desire part, then the becoming part takes care of itself. When you say reality, asks a 30-ish guy named Sean, I mean consensual, dualistic reality. This is the dream state we're talking about, not truth. They're mutually exclusive? Well, yeah, I say, since truth exists and untruth doesn't. Oh, he says. Okay. This isn't truth stuff, anyway. This is rightful inheritance stuff. This is about understanding your place in things. We're talking about the fact that the universe you find yourself in is yours to do with as you please. If you think of it in terms of a dream, then what we're talking about is like lucid dreaming, shaping the dream to your will, as opposed to non-lucid dreaming, being shaped by events and environment and so forth. This seems like a mixed message, says an older guy. On the one hand, you talk about releasing the tiller, and now you seem to be saying we should grab the tiller and take control of our lives. Good point, I say. It's about taking control of your life, and that means one thing, releasing it. Unconditional surrender. That's something to be done consciously and with clear intent. Nothing comes before the transition to adulthood, and no one moves forward without it. The mixed message comes from the paradoxical nature of losing your life to find it. This is all so confusing, says Karen, who got this conversation rolling with her initial question about prayer. It would be so nice if you could just press a button or take a pill and all this stuff just makes sense. Everyone laughs in commiseration. Regardless of how complex and daunting all this may seem, I respond, I assure you, there's only one thing to worry about, making the transition to human adulthood. That's where life begins. Nothing else means anything. There is no secondary objective or consolation prize. No amount of knowledge or understanding or spiritual experience could be of any value if you're still stuck in the segregated state. That should be simple enough. You have one goal, to move from the segregated state to the integrated state, die to the flesh and be born of the spirit. That's the button you have to press. Silence while I take a drink. But how do we really do that? Asks Karen. I mean, really? Everyone speaks up now in support of this question. They want to make something happen in their lives. At least, that's the role they're playing. One of these 30 might actually do something in the next decade, but probably not. They don't understand the nature of their captivity or the fact that they're happy in it. So their chances of moving beyond the talk stage are very slim. You have to open your eyes, I reply. That's the answer. Look at life honestly, see it clearly, and everything else follows naturally from that. Everything follows automatically from clear seeing. They stare at me in silence for a few moments. Like, how are we not being honest? The younger guy, Logan, asks with a welcome edge of attitude. I consider his question as I pace. There are many answers, but the most obvious is probably the most revealing. By coming here, I say, what we're all doing by coming here to these meetings is essentially dishonest. We tell ourselves that we're here as part of our process of spiritual growth, or because we want to understand new ideas, or we want to make some positive changes in our lives. But is that true? People don't really want to change, and those who do don't go to meetings or listen to people talk about change or read books or whatever. They take action. They take up arms. They make something happen. They don't simply move from one part of the herd to another. I could be much harsher about the self-deception these folks are practicing by coming here, but I really don't want to be harsh at all. I never want to get impassioned or confrontational, but when the subject is the integrated state, the urge is there. The urge to shake people awake, to slap them out of their stupor, to rub their nose in their own goofy beliefs. It seems like it would work, but I know it wouldn't. Logan speaks up and saves me from myself. "I disagree with that," he says excitedly. "I think what we're doing by coming here is pretty cool. It's like we know we're stuck in this bad situation you and Brett talk about, like we're unconscious or imprisoned or whatever, and we come here to meet, like a band of secret plotters. We come here because we want to kick some ass." Logan's youthful enthusiasm is infectious. Everyone laughs. A few clap. Even Brett is smiling. "That's a nice thing to believe," I say after everyone is quiet again. "Sometimes I almost believe it myself. But the reality is very different. Realistically speaking, what we're really doing here is no more radical than thumbing through a magazine or going to the mall." This elicits a response of murmured disapproval. "This is not a secret meeting, and we are not revolutionaries plotting the overthrow of an evil dictator. This is a toothless conspiracy, like a prison escape club. It's listed in the prison directory after the drama club and before the glee club. This event, us coming together here and discussing these subjects, is a sanctioned event, fully approved by the very regime we plot against. All the books and magazines and events of the escape club are prison-sponsored. Wherever two or more are gathered together," says Maya, "I am in your midst." There are no secret gatherings. There is no plotting. There are no overthrows. The only escape possible is one person, on their own, alone, slipping off by themselves, into the black. "Into the black?" asks Logan. "You have to go into that darkness you've spent your life avoiding and denying. You have to get to the place where you'd rather go into that blackness than continue avoiding it. Coming here is just another way of maintaining plausible denial." "I agree. It's not fair. It's way too much. You should have done it when you were 12. But how could you have known? But now your situation is much worse, and that's what it takes." "I'm sorry," says Logan. "I just don't see it." "Yeah," I say, nodding. "That's my point." "Oh," he says. "Think of the tremendous explosive force of a space shuttle launching off the pad, the amount of raw energy it takes to escape from the Earth's gravitational pull. What would that sort of explosive force look like in your life? What would it take to ignite it? What could fuel such a powerful event? Not love, not serenity or compassion, not pretty stories about the life everlasting, or a heavenly abode." I pause for a quick metaphor switch. "In the prison of human childhood, you are not really alive. Until you understand that, until you see it for yourself, there is no way you can muster the mental resolve and emotional intensity necessary to change your circumstances. We like to believe it's about becoming more spiritual and more compassionate, but that's just what they tell the prisoners to keep them cheerfully and harmlessly engaged. There is only one possible objective. You must die to be reborn. And to do that, I recommend you use spiritual autolysis to begin the process of thinking clearly and freeing your thoughts from emotion-dense clouds of self-limiting beliefs. Use spiritual autolysis as a mental approach and prayer as an emotional approach. Pray for intent. Pray for authentic desire. Pray to be able to pray better. Or? Asks Logan. I shrug. Or this, I say, raising my hands to indicate life as they presently know it. But this doesn't seem so bad to them. So real change is real unlikely. Our eyes are wide open, and we see reality with perfect clarity. This is so obvious that it's beyond any possible doubt. It's also untrue. Our vision is so obscured by mental and emotional flotsam and jetsam of selfhood that what we call stark reality is really just a soft glow seen through tightly shut eyelids. Just enough light getting through to illuminate the internal dreamscape. It is owing entirely to our belief that our eyes are open, that the spiritual quest is doomed from the start, and that so many who think they're well along or finished have never really begun. No matter how unwavering we are in our commitment, or how steadfast in our determination, no matter how much knowledge we amass or wisdom we attain, no matter what hardships we endure or what sacrifices we make, no matter what scriptures we adhere to or what deities we appease, it's all just a desperate ploy to keep ourselves from doing the one thing that could make a difference. Taking personal responsibility. Thinking for ourselves. At the point where we begin our search, we have already overshot the objective, and every step takes us further away. In the search for truth, God, meaning supra-consciousness, divine union, bliss, salvation, or whatever other spiritual tale we might chase, self is never itself subjected to critical scrutiny. We simply accept that we are as we think we are, and that reality is as we think it is, and go from there. We accept these facts as established and certain, and proceed from that point onward. Thus, the primary error from which all others arise has already been committed and is safe from detection and correction. All our discernment and discrimination and intelligence is turned outward from self, not inward, against it. To put it in terms of the cinematic retelling of Plato's cave allegory, The Matrix, what growth or development is possible if we never discover that we're living in a glass coffin and reality is being piped in like elevator music? Chapter 21, The Power of Prayer. Of the terrible doubt of appearances, of the uncertainty, after all, that we may be deluded, that maybe reliance and hope are but speculations after all, that maybe identity beyond the grave is a beautiful fable only, maybe the things I perceive, the animals, plants, men, hills, shining and flowing waters, the skies of day and night, colors, densities, forms. Maybe these are, as doubtless they are, only apparitions, and the real something has yet to be known. How often they dart out of themselves, as if to confound me and mock me. How often I think neither I know nor any man knows aught of them. Walt Whitman. Prayer deserves a closer look. Prayer is where the rubber meets the road. It's the thing that, regardless of other things, all these people in this horse arena have experimented with. They've all prayed heartfelt prayers, and they've all reflected on the efficacy of prayer. They all have some sort of deep, personal experience of prayer. They have nothing in the way of knowledge, and might assume there's none to be had, but there is. Everything that works, works a certain way, and prayer works. The thing they don't know is that prayer isn't about changing the rules, but coming into alignment with them. It's not about wishing things were otherwise, but merging with the way things are. It's not about the once-in-a-lifetime miracle, but the every breath miraculous. Living with eyes closed, we lack not just vision, but perspective. We don't understand our relationship to our environment, or anything in our environment. We think things are ours that are not ours, that things last that don't last, that things are true that are not true. We flex our fingers and we think, of course my hand works. It's my hand. It does what I tell it to. But layers and layers of wrong knowing are harbored in even this seemingly simple observation. I'd like to spend a few minutes taking a closer look at what's wrong with the word prayer, I continue. Not what's wrong with the actual process, but what's wrong with the way we understand it, as typified by the word prayer. Maybe we can demystify it a bit, clear away the mystical mist, and see it as a natural and dependable process. Okay? Seems to be. For one thing, the word prayer has the feeling of one entity making a request of another, as if a little guy is asking a big guy for something, like a peasant begging a king for a crust of bread. This common assumption that we're weak and helpless children in Big Daddy's house infects many people's thinking and is very symptomatic of human childhood. Okay? Lots of unsure okays. Okay. Another misleading thing about the word prayer is the connotation that you may or may not get what you're asking for. This ties in with worthiness, like you'll only get what you pray for if you deserve it, like Big Daddy has to be pleased with you before rewarding you. As if there's a judging agent or agency to whom one's prayer is really a plea or a plea bargain. This is what's behind sacrifices and tithing and all the other things we do to try to get into Big Daddy's good graces. I see recognition in their faces. I would also say that prayer is an underperforming proposition, I continue. Meaning that when prayers do seem to be answered, the answer probably won't measure up to what we prayed for. Contrast this to eyes-open manifestation, which will, as a rule, exceed our highest hopes and expectations. That gets a muffled response of nods and grins, as if they're all familiar with the ask and ye shall receive routine, where you really, really ask and only sorta, kinda, maybe, receive. Another thing about prayer is that it seems like a last resort, like conventional methods, have failed. So we're turning in desperation to prayer. Like with a pimple on prom night, maybe we try diet changes and skin cleansers and makeup first, and when all else fails, we turn to prayer. "Ask," jokes Jeff, "and the good Lord shall provide." "Very good," I say, and that raises another problem with the word prayer. It's inextricably tied in with all our religious baggage. All you want is a pimple to disappear before prom night. And now there's Jesus, the Son of God, who died a crappy death for your crappy sins, who you haven't spoken to in years. And now you're going to call him up to bitch about a zit? They laugh. Unlike prayer, manifestation is a first and only resort. Once we understand what it really is and how it really works, it naturally becomes our sole mode of operating in the world, not just in getting what we want, but in knowing how to want and what to want, in knowing what to do and why to do it. Instead of a desperate plea for something we want, manifestation becomes our way of moving through life, of interfacing with the universe. I pace in the sand and let the words come. Which brings us to the most important difference between prayer and manifestation. Prayer is specific. You want something, so you ask for it. A zit to disappear. Good news from the doctor. Your child to have 10 fingers and toes. But manifestation isn't specific. It's not just about getting what you want. It's about everything you do, and how you do it, and who you are, and how you move through the world. It's about shaping the dream state and moving within it in this seamless confluence of self and not self. It's the erasing of the line between dreamer and dream. You're not just manifesting a car or new shoes. You're manifesting yourself. And all the rest follows naturally and effortlessly from that. You can see why prayer is a pretty skimpy little concept next to that. "Is manifestation anything like synchronicity?" asks Karen. "Sort of," I say, "but synchronicity is another ambiguous term, like prayer, that we use to describe a phenomenon we dimly perceive and don't understand. I think Dr. Jung coined the term synchronicity. The commonly cited example is that Jung was discussing scarab beetles with a patient in a New York high-rise when a very unlikely beetle appeared outside his window. That's actually a pretty good example for our purposes because it shows how starkly brazen synchronicity has to be before we are able to detect it. We might think of synchronicity as this kind of outlandish coincidence. But if our eyes were open, we'd see that synchronicity is not a rare occurrence at all. It's the basic organizing principle of energy. If you need an Egyptian beetle to tap on your Manhattan window to teach you about synchronicity, then the real lesson isn't that you've seen something very unusual, but that you're too blind to see what's very normal. "But how is it possible for everyone to be as blind as you're saying?" asks Jeff, who is sitting with Karen. "For that very reason," I reply, "because it's everyone." "And how would we actually go about opening our eyes?" asks Jan, a 50-ish female with close-cropped gray hair, who has made several remarks on this and previous evenings, which seemed more intended to convey her skepticism than to get answers. "It is a metaphor, I take it." "Maybe," I say. "Or maybe that's the real seeing, and what we do with our physical eyes is the metaphor. We begin seeing clearly by first seeing that we are asleep, locked in the constricting coils of our own emotional energy. Once we truly understand that we are asleep within the dream state, then we can begin in earnest to awaken ourselves, which is done by hacking away at these constricting coils. This is the transition that, in a healthy society, we would all undergo naturally and with relative ease in our early teens. In the world as we know it, though, very few ever make the transition, and of those who do, far fewer manage to continue developing beyond it to any significant degree. There's always a spiritual inertia at work, resisting motion or change. It's built in, way deep. That's why a word like further is so important. "But you have?" Jan asks. "You've continued developing beyond the transition to adulthood?" "I have, yes. I would probably be the equivalent of a young adult." "Well, young adult with an asterisk, I believe, due to the enlightenment thing." "So you'd be a young adult?" Jan asks defensively. "And the rest of us are what? Just children?" "Not really children," I say. "More like unborn, yet to emerge from the womb. Life begins when we are born of the spirit. There's no possibility of development prior to this emergence. When I say I'd probably be like a young adult, I mean a young adult in a world where we developed in a healthy, normal manner, where life was a continuous journey of growth and expansion and understanding, where a 35-year-old was a significantly more developed being than a 33-year-old, not just more solidified. Such a world wouldn't even have words like luck or prayer or manifestation or synchronicity. Those words are appropriate in an eye-closed world where our best thinking is quasi-mystical guesswork based on flimsy evidence like bugs on windows, but not for an eyes-opened world where everything is visible and plain to behold. Jan has been making skeptical but non-productive comments throughout the evening. Nothing of any particular merit, just doubtful remarks made in dubious tones, as if she's too smart to be buying what I'm selling. Her brand of snootiness is a type of spiritual shielding that is not unusual in these forums. From her perspective, I'm the used car salesman trying to sell her a lemon. I'm the sleazy politician trying to swindle her out of her precious vote. I'm the greedy corporation dispensing sugar-coated cancer. I'm the proselytizing TV preacher trying to wrangle her into the fold. I'm the smooth-talking guy on the next bar stool trying to turn her heart against her head. We are surrounded by this buyer-seller dynamic in all areas of our lives, and spirituality is no different. To someone like Jan, I'm just one of many suitors vying for her spiritual heart and, she may well assume, her purse. She thinks she has something I want, and she's right, though she doesn't know what it is and wouldn't be reluctant to provide it if she did. I don't want her heart or mind or money. I don't want to save her or enlighten her. I don't want her to believe in the spiritually elevated character I'm portraying so I can believe in it too. All I want is thoughtful dialogue, insightful feedback, challenging conversation. But she can't give me that because she's too wrapped up in her defensive role of discerning spiritual consumer to come out and play. We take a 15-minute break, during which Brett and I go for a walk and talk about small things. When we return, everyone is already back in their seats and quiet. I look at Brett, and she scoots me out back in front. "So how would manifestation deal with a pimple on prom night?" asks Brad, getting a laugh. "That's a good question," I say, "but it's not an apples and oranges comparison, because at the heart of this conversation, we're not talking about two methods, prayer and manifestation. We're talking about two paradigms, segregated and integrated." "Okay," says Brad. "So how would you personally deal with a zit on prom night?" His question gets a lot of crowd approval. I look over and see Brett grinning at me. I grin back. "To start with," I reply, "instead of making it wrong, I'd know without question that it was right, and wonder why. So right away, there's a divergence away from segregated wrongness toward integrated rightness. I might spend a minute wondering if I'd committed an error of some sort, if I had lapsed into unconsciousness, resulting in this untimely blemish. But that's just habit, and I wouldn't find any such error. Then I'd spend another moment wondering if there was anything to be understood, clearly understood, not make-believe or guesswork, from this curious pimple. I doubt I'd see anything at this stage, but it's always good to check. I would remain alert, however, since the appearance of this pimple in these circumstances would strike me as so unlikely as to certainly have ulterior, though as yet unseen, workings." "You wouldn't try to heal it or hide it?" asks Brad. "Oh, I probably would, sure. If I was in a situation where I wanted to look my best, I wouldn't be any happier to have a zit than anyone else would. I wouldn't pretend I was okay with it. I'm not in the habit of trying to act other than as I'm inclined. I play my role faithfully, whether or not I understand every detail. And in these circumstances, my character would wish to heal or hide the blemish." "What did you mean by unseen workings?" asks Karen. "I'm not new to all this. I've been doing this for a long time, prior to my awakening, even. And it's a built-in function of my waking consciousness now, not something I have to stop and think about and perform. In this scenario, where I'm going to a special event, a prom, which entails dressing up, personal grooming, planning, and special arrangements, the appearance of a pimple would be about as subtle, as they say, as a fart in a bathysphere. I may not understand the purpose of it right away, but something this unlikely would not remain a mystery for long. An explanation would surely be forthcoming."
"Forthcoming like how?"
"I can't stretch this scenario out that far. Within a few hours, certainly within a few days, what seemed like a minor nuisance would be revealed as a perfect piece in a larger, elegant whole. It would all make perfect sense." "But sometimes a zit is just a zit," says Brad philosophically. "Maybe in your world," I say, "not in mine. That would be like if a walrus crawled in here right now and you asked me about it and I said sometimes a walrus is just a walrus."
"Well," says Brad, "if a walrus crawled in here right now, I think there'd be some sort of rational explanation for it."
"That's exactly what I'm saying," I agree. "We'd be sure there was some explanation, even though we had no idea what it might be yet. And even if we never found out for sure. Saying a walrus is just a walrus would be a totally unacceptable way of explaining such a bizarre event. Likewise, I wouldn't dismiss this zit we're talking about as just a bizarre event, or assume it wasn't understandable, just because I had yet to understand it. That sort of insistence and distrust is wholly segregated
and egoistic. Even if I never understood in fullness, I would never make the assumption that it had been, how do I even say it, a random event? Chaotic? An element of disorder? There is no disorder. Nothing is random or chaotic, only fully perceived or not. This isn't what I believe, as you must assume. This is what I see. You wouldn't pray or manifest for the zit to disappear? No. That would be making it wrong, which wouldn't even occur to me. I may not like having a zit, and I may try to hide it or heal it, but I wouldn't think of it as wrong. They don't look like they believe me. In this prom scenario, I say, my wishes would already be in place. At some earlier point, I would have spent a few seconds expressing the desire that the evening went well, that everything happened for the best, whatever that might be. And I would have released that desire. I would have let it go and forgotten about it. There would be no panicky revising of my desires based on the appearance of a pimple. That sort of fearful distrust could not occur in me. Nothing of this is vague to me. It's all very specific and constant. If the universe wants me to have this pimple, then obviously that's what I want too. I may not like it or understand it at the time, but I know it's part of something I don't fully see yet. And I know that the reasoning will become clear soon enough. Something this peculiar wouldn't remain a mystery for long. Now they're quiet. I can see the next question coming before anyone thinks to ask it. Let's not leave this at the trivial level of a facial blemish, I say. If I get trapped in a burning car tonight, I would still not think to ascribe wrongness to the situation. Being trapped in a burning car and having a pimple on prom night are only different in scale. I may not like burning to death, and I may not understand it at the time, and I would certainly fight against it. But I wouldn't assume that the universe had made an error, or that me being trapped in a burning car was somehow not the way it was supposed to be. So you'd be okay with it? Asked Brad. I don't understand what it would mean not to be okay with what it is. I can't process it. It doesn't translate into anything I can make sense of. It has no counterpart in my paradigm. Being in a burning car would cause me to feel a profound degree of discontent, which I would seek to remedy, probably by escaping from the car and extinguishing the flames. But I wouldn't think of it as somehow other than right. They don't look like they believe me. The thing I'm not explaining well, I tell them, is that this is not a different system of belief. It's a different paradigm of being. It's not something you can plug into your worldview. My surrender to the perfect and unerring will of the universe, which I do not perceive as a thing apart from myself, is absolute. This is not like a belief that can bend or break under pressure. No crisis of faith is possible, because there is no faith involved. This is a different state of being I'm talking about, as distinctly different as awake and asleep, as adulthood and childhood, as sanity and insanity. We approach spirituality under the false assumption that we need more knowledge or deeper understanding or stronger beliefs or special experiences. But it's none of those things. It's an entirely different state of being. I have seen this relationship work with unerring perfection for more than 2 decades. I am not an outside observer of it. I am a co-creative partner with it. It's not a relationship between 2 entities. It's a new and different type of entity. This is what it means to be in a different paradigm. This is what it means to say that my reality is different from your reality. And as long as you're all staring at me like I'm a head case anyway, I might as well put the cherry on top. If I get a pimple on prom night or find myself trapped in a burning car, my response is never fear or anger or disappointment or doubt. My response is always the same. It's thank you. It's always thank you. They don't look like they believe me. Chapter 22. The Best of All Possible Worlds. "Do you believe," said Candide, "that men have always massacred each other as they do today? That they have always been liars, cheats, traitors, ingrates, brigands, idiots, thieves, scoundrels, gluttons, drunkards, misers, envious, ambitious, bloody-minded, calumniators, debauchees, fanatics, hypocrites, and fools?" "Do you believe," said Martin, "that hawks have always eaten pigeons when they have found them?"
"Yes, without doubt," said Candide.
"Well then," said Martin, "if hawks have always had the same character, why should you imagine that men may have changed theirs?" Voltaire, Candide. There are two literary observations that would be fun and illuminating to make at this point. The first is Candide, which was Voltaire's satiric response to the optimistic assertion by Gottfried Leibniz that all is for the best in this, the best of all possible worlds. This assertion actually comes as a solution in the pseudo-philosophical line of inquiry called theodicy, which seeks to ease our spiritual dissonance by reconciling our inner belief in God's love with the outer reality of suffering and evil. Theodicy is not a valid philosophical inquiry because it presupposes an omnipotent, omniscient, beneficent God, and seeks to reconcile evil within those preset terms. In this same sense, all philosophy is pseudo-philosophy, and all science is pseudo-science because, as a precondition of their very existence, they accept the make-believe reality of the dream state as real reality, and erect their systems of knowledge on this baseless basis. Candide, like Buddha, was raised in privileged isolation, shielded from the ugliness of the world, and, like Buddha, goes out and discovers it for himself in a way that is devastating to his cultivated worldview. Both Candide and Buddha then undergo suffering and hardship owing to wrong thinking, and both eventually end up finding their respective middle ways. Candide is raised to believe that everything is part of God's plan, and that, whether we see it or not, everything is for the best. To interpret any horror or evil or suffering as anything other than for the best is simply to display an ignorance of the fact that God has a grand design which we are not fit to judge. The main theme of Candide is the satirization of this absolute optimism by taking it out of the theory of the classroom and subjecting it to the practical rigors of a gruesomely unbest world. The story subjects its characters to every natural and man-made horror and every sort of suffering to put this optimism to the test, and their philosophy fails miserably. In the end, even Dr. Pangloss, the optimistic philosopher, admits that, though he still maintains that all is for the best, he doesn't believe it. In the words of the yet untested Dr. Pangloss, professor of
metaphysico-theologico-cosmolo-nigology. "It is demonstrable," said he, "that things cannot be otherwise than as they are. For all being created for an end, all is necessarily for the best end. Observe that the nose has been formed to bear spectacles. Thus we have spectacles. Legs are visibly designed for stockings, and we have stockings. Stones were made to be hewn and to construct castles. Therefore, my lord has a magnificent castle, for the greatest baron in the province ought to be the best lodged. Pigs were made to be eaten. Therefore, we eat pork all the year round. Consequently, they who assert that all is well have said a foolish thing. They should have said, all is for the best." Overlooking the intellectual whorishness of it, and despite the faultiness of the reasoning by which the result was arrived at, the philosophy of Candide's instructor, Dr. Pangloss, is ultimately and knowably correct. If we algebraically reduce the equation by canceling out equal and opposite judgments, taking good from one side and evil from the other, for instance, we are left with an egoless and spiritually palate-cleansing observation. Whatever happens must be the best thing that could happen, because it is the thing that does happen. Ultimately, the only criteria we have by which to determine what is best is what occurs. Or, as Alexander Pope succinctly put it, whatever is right. The ocean cannot violate the idea of an ocean. If there is conflict between the idea and actual, then the idea is an error. The ocean can't be an error because what it does is what it is. The tsunami that wipes out villages isn't good or bad, or right or wrong. It simply is. The destination isn't where we're going. It's where we are. This is the clear and natural egoless perspective. Where is the part of the ocean that feels bad about the tsunami that wipes out entire villages? Where is the thinking part of the ocean where actions are interpreted and future behaviors adapted or modified accordingly? Where is the planning and scheduling done? Where does it store its memories and knowledge and opinions and beliefs? Where is the feeling part where the ocean senses its own majesty and power and beauty? Where does it feel pride and shame? Where does it fear the time when it will no longer be? Where does the ocean keep its hopes and ambitions, its regrets and misgivings? Which part conspires against one human enterprise in favor of another? How does the ocean judge? How does it know right from wrong? Finding no answers to these questions, are we to assume that the ocean is an inanimate, lifeless thing with no intelligence? Obviously not. The ocean is a living, vital, dynamic system of pure intelligence. It performs an operation of incalculable complexity every second of every day, around the world, from one end of Earth time to the other, with never the slightest deviation from perfection. This pure intelligence is found everywhere, from galaxies to subatomic particles, and everywhere beyond and in between. Every insect, every person, every thought, every breeze, every planetary body, every dust mote and doorknob, every drop of dew and speck of time. "I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the journey work of the stars," wrote Whitman. "I discovered the secret of the sea in meditation upon the dewdrop," wrote Gibran. The ocean is just one infinitesimal part of an infinite system in which we too are infinitesimal parts. Yet no part is greater or lesser. No part is a part. Every part contains the totality. The ocean is a single thing. To be a part of the ocean is to be the ocean. Tat tvam asi, that thou art. This, too, is the egoless perspective of the integrated state. The universe is pure intelligence, absolute, unerring, perfect. So what's the difference between the ocean and the stars and the subatomic world and you? Ego. Ego-clad beings alone are capable of imperfection. We alone, in our segregated condition, are capable of all the things the universe isn't. Error, folly, emotionality, stupidity, appreciation, love, hate, exploration, awe, self-importance, meaning, art, genocide, and a very long list of other qualities, including, most importantly for our purposes, aspiration. We can aspire beyond ourselves, beyond segregated selfhood. We can transcend our own natures. We can aspire to divest ourselves of our self-limiting programming and merge back into the integrated condition from which ego artificially segregates us. Ultimately, of course, an ego-bound humanity is a subsystem, just like the ocean and the stars and the grass, and what looks like error from within is perfection from without. We are perfect in our imperfection, flawed by design. When we divest ourselves of our egoic insistence on judging actions, intentions, thoughts, and feelings as right or wrong, good or bad, positive or negative, we see that the only criteria by which anything might be judged is by whether or not it occurs. The heretic is correct in committing his heresy, if he does, and the angry mob is correct in burning him to death, if they do. There is no right or wrong or good or evil, only is and isn't. Whatever is right. All is for the best in this, the best of all possible worlds. The other literary observation to make here is from 1984, where the difference between a belief and a paradigm is highlighted by protagonist Winston Smith's axiom, "Freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. If that is granted, all else follows." What Winston learns later, during the course of his reprogramming in the Ministry of Love, is that what can be granted can also be ungranted, and that 2 + 2 = 5, or 3, or whatever the party says it equals. Making that minor adjustment to Winston's belief set, however, is not enough for his benefactors, malefactors. Even his last shred of selfhood, that truest truth in his heart of hearts, which he is most certain can never be taken from him, his love for Julia, can, and as he will learn in room 101, be stripped away in a minute or two, just like any other belief. Thus is Winston Smith's Buddha killed. With the exception of the subjective I am, all knowledge is just belief, and all beliefs are just costume jewelry that can be torn off and tossed in the gutter like the cheap egoic adornments they are. We don't have beliefs. They have us. 2 + 2 = 4 is exactly as true as 2 + 2 = 5. The truest truth we keep in our heart of hearts is no more true than the truths we tell children and traffic cops. 2 plus 2 makes whatever we say it makes. This is what O'Brien, Winston Smith's savior, persecutor, refers to as collective solipsism, or its opposite. "But how can you control matter?" Winston burst out. "You don't even control the climate or the law of gravity. And there are disease, pain, death." O'Brien silenced him by a movement of his hand. "We control matter because we control the mind. Reality is inside the skull. You will learn by degrees, Winston. There is nothing that we could not do. Invisibility, levitation, anything. I could float off this floor like a soap bubble if I wished to. I do not wish to, because the party does not wish it. You must get rid of those 19th century ideas about the laws of nature. We make the laws of nature." The truth is that no belief is true. And to say that any belief is true is to open the floodgates and say that all beliefs are true. No untruth is more or less true than any other untruth. When we are lucid within the dream state, we see that 2 plus 2 equals 4. But when we are non-lucid within the dream state, no such restrictions apply. And even 2 plus 2 equals 4 is just another belief. Anything plus anything equals anything. 2 plus 2 equals whatever we say it equals. It can equal different things to different people at different times for different reasons. In the sleeping dream state, your 2 twos can be 7, and mine can be 1. Maybe the 2 plus 2 equal 5s and the 2 plus 2 equal 3s hate each other and have been warring for centuries. Maybe they're barely aware of each other. Or maybe they're uneasily allied against the 2 plus 2 equals 7s. The world belongs to the 2 plus 2 equals 4s at the moment. But as 1984 helps us see, that can change. That's life in the non-lucid dream state, where truth is arbitrary and reality is only an hopeless fancy.